Support for Commodity Week comes from the Friends of WILL and from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign. With crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Learn more at sfarmmarketing.com.
This is the October 4 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists today include Alan Brugler, Brugler Marketing and Management out of Omaha, Nebraska, Steve Freed from ADM Investor Services in Chicago, Illinois, and Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online, listen to us on demand anytime you'd like at WILLAG.org. Alan Brugler, let's start with you. What are our discussion points for the day? What are the things you'd like to take up?
Well, I think the big question is, did we put in the fall low in the corn and the beans, or are we going to take out these speed lines and these overhead resistance lines and take beans back up to $9? We've got a crop report next week to talk about what's the USDA going to do with yields. We already know what they have to do with ending stocks. And, of course, the whole trade arena is an evergreen subject.
And Steve Freed of ADM Investor Services.
Well, I think that given the carries in the markets and, you know, people talking about normal crops next year worldwide, I mean, should the farmer be looking at selling 19 corn and soybeans now, or are they going to wait?
And Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting.
I really don't have a lot to add other than maybe how the macro issues may come into play in agriculture. You know, we've had an abnormally low interest rates. There's a whole generation or two generations of people out there that think 2% interest rates is normal. And I think most of us on this panel have all experienced much higher rates in our early careers, buying automobiles and homes and whatnot. And we all know what higher interest rates and stronger dollar did to the world market in the 80s. And I think that's something that I guess I'm watching on a long-term basis that might come back and bite us pretty hard someday.
I suppose I remember some of that, too. I think 8% was my first loan on the home. Of course, you can be down at 2, 3, or 4, depending on where you are in your marketplace at this point. And it does make a difference, Dan, over time, and makes a big difference in agriculture. That was what happened as we led into the 1980s from the 1970s, kind of the boom-bust cycle, and set up a really depressed era for the agricultural economy during the 1980s. I don't know that you're thinking that it'll be that bad, but agriculture could suffer if we started to see higher interest rates, I take it.
I think you have to remember that goes with inflation, too, though. Those interest rates that we had in the 80s, and my first home loan was 9.75%, you have to remember that a big chunk of that was inflation, and only a small part of it was actually the real interest rate. But that's another thing that the younger generation doesn't know how to deal with, and that is an inflationary environment where your input costs are going up by multiple percentage points, and your selling prices go higher than you think they will because of the same inflation.
Yeah, so it is a bit of a double-edged sword because you are getting a higher price too, but everything is moving up at the same time. Dan, you had more to say about this on the macro issues. Are you really concerned about the future of agriculture?
Longer term, I don't think it's going to happen overnight, but yeah, I think longer term you have to be worried. Anytime a government, I guess I'm much too much of a free economist, supply-demand person. But when you deliberately alter the supply-demand balance sheet, either through legislation or some other way, usually when that builds up certain problems in the economy, then that all has to explode at some point in time. I mean, it's just like when Nixon had the wage and price controls on in the early 70s, that just created a bigger problem when those wage and price controls were lifted. And, of course, I live in Texas, so, I mean, I've never seen such a hot economy. I mean, they can't build roads fast enough. They can't build houses fast enough. They can't do anything fast enough. And home prices are going up so fast every year that people are getting sticker shock on their real estate taxes because, you know, they don't know what to think of it anymore. But something like that, I don't think can go on forever. You know, something's going to cool down. And the Fed chairman said earlier this week that he thought the economy was so good, it was too good to be true. So that tells me that he's looking at higher interest rates to cool this thing off at some point in time. Now, I know the communist states up here north, they never really got too warm. So, you know, they're losing population as it is. So, you know, they really don't have a house shortage problem, probably. But something's going to give. I mean, the stock market is hot. I've made a lot of money in that stock market. But, you know, I wonder if it's time to take it out and put it in interest rates and then maybe get ready to buy some of this $14,000 ground for $7,500 5 years down the road.
And so we're gonna leave this topic area, but I wanted to take just a moment to promo the Farm Assets Conference, which we haven't quite started selling tickets for yet. That's the Tuesday before Thanksgiving in Normal, Illinois. And we'll be discussing some alternatives for producers, because as I look forward, I've been thinking about what farmers will need to do to stay on the land in the coming 5 to 10 years. I think most everybody recognizes that it probably will be an interesting, maybe a little rough 5 to 10 years for agriculture, and we'll have Anheuser-Busch along with McDonald's to come in to talk about how they see themselves reaching deeper into the supply chain so that they'll skip over the ADMs of the world and or the Cargills or the Bungies and reach deeper, or maybe through them, and reach deeper into the supply chain and actually tap the farmer directly on the shoulder and what kind of niche markets that creates for those farmers who might think of themselves as small or middle-sized, that 1,500-acre farmer, which is the average size of the FBF farm in Illinois, and what they might need to do in order to align themselves to collect more premium out of the marketplace. So that'll all come up during the Farm Assets Conference. Hopefully you'll be able to get some tickets here pretty shortly. I'll put that online. You'll get the tickets, of course, but hopefully you'll be able to come in November. That's the 20th day, and we'll be in Normal, Illinois. Now, I want to talk to you, Steve Fried of ADM Investor Services in Chicago, just a little bit about how trade has impacted flows of grain across the planet. From your vantage point, what's changed in the last 6 months to a year in the way soybeans and or corn are moved around the planet? Can that be quickly changed back if there's much of a difference?
Well, the first thing, you know, when you're talking about macros, we are seeing some funds come in and buying, especially corn right now. It's a couple of reasons. Number one, that they feel that it's cheap, it has value. And then I think that there is a little bit of an inflation bug out there, probably led by the crude oil market more than anything else. And so we are seeing new buyers come in that are not necessarily fundamentalists. And, you know, we just don't know how long that's going to last. As far as trade is concerned, you know, last year, China bought 28 million tons of soybeans from the United States. Globally, they bought 93 million tons. The perception right now today is that they won't buy any beans from the United States in 2019. Their purchase power might drop to 88 million tons, and that Brazil will ship them 81 million tons. So I think from a long-term perspective, I think that China's doing everything they can to try to buy as many beans as they can from Brazil. And the only question mark from their vantage point is logistics. Can Brazil ship 81 million tons or down the road even more to China? But I think Chinese are trying to do everything they can to help them increase their production, increase their logistics, and, you know, kind of avoid any problems. So that type of trade, I don't think we'll get back. And I think that was already in motion before these trade issues. I think this just helped move it along faster.
So this is part of what the Chinese plan over the next 5 years, and I have to think about what that plan's called, the Belt and Road.
Belt and Road
Initiative. The Belt and Road Initiative might have been. So it's just moved it up in time, and I guess, Alan, you can chime in here.
Well, I think the second part of that, though, is if Brazil's really going to ship at that level, and of course that does require them to have a good crop in 2019, there is a ripple effect to that. Our studies basically suggest that the U.S. would only lose 3 to 4 million tons of net exports for the year, just because South America doesn't have the inventory to support China and support all their former customers. You see big volumes moving into Europe. The U.S. is starting to crack some of those other markets as well. Mexico had a huge purchase last week. So we call it the balloon theory of Earth, which is supply and demand doesn't leave the Earth. If you pull it out of one spot, it's got to, you push it, it pokes out somewhere else. And Chinese overall consumption is probably going to be down, but we think for the most part the U.S. is going to replace that business. The bad part is it takes lower prices to do that, and I'm sure Steve could speak to the logistical disruptions that occur when you're trying to change which direction you're running this stuff.
I just want to add two things. I mean, when you start talking about, you know, the weak basis levels in the Dakotas, I mean, that's 100% due to the fact that rail is not moving to the Pacific Northwest to load the boats to China. And, you know, I don't think that that's going to change anytime soon. But, you know, when you sit down and say, okay, I'm going to put a supply and demand together for 18 and 19 U.S. beans. Basically, the USDA has a soybean export number of 2 billion bushels. A lot of private people are using 1.8 billion. And so you just automatically add that to the carryout. And so, you know, that I think is showing that, okay, we will get some business from other countries, but it cannot overcome the fact that the number one buyer in the world is not going to buy 28 million tons from the United States.
So logistically, if you look at a basis map, Steve, and I haven't done this for about 3 or 4 weeks, but you can clearly see that there is a dividing line at the Illinois River, which means everything west is trying to come out of the Dakotas, Iowa, Minnesota, as far as exports go, and force their way down the Illinois River. And then from the east of the Illinois River, that would be a more normal drain, though the basis is much wider than it has been, because there's just a whole lot of soybeans trying to go out the Mississippi River. Logistically, is there a reason for that to happen? Meaning, are there enough buyers on the other end to take those soybeans? It doesn't appear that's the case. That's what you've said, or not yet anyway. And how does that interrupt potentially the ability to move corn down the Mississippi River as well?
I think the corn situation is up to the farmer and whether or not he is going to sell grain on a normal basis. That, you know, I don't think logistically from a barge standpoint there's going to be any problem loading boats of corn at the Gulf. And Mexico is now our number one buyer, so that's pretty much a rail market. And again, I don't think you're going to change too much where the bases are. I think that we should be able to load beans. Obviously in the South, there's a quality issue with mold, and these rains that are going to go across the Midwest, you know, we have to watch that. But, you know, the processor is sitting there willing to buy beans with a record crush and very high crush margins. It's just that, you know, right now, especially like in Iowa and things like that, the farmer isn't right now willing to sell it. He's pretty focused on trying to get the stuff harvested before it rains. So, you know, you've got Iowa processors willing to pay up basis-wise to try to get ownership, and then you've got exporters that really don't want the ownership. I mean, it's been a long time since we saw the negative soybean SIF value that we saw about a week ago. And the other thing that you kind of have to think in the back of your mind is that the Brazilian soybean crop is being planted very early and probably could see some beans out of Brazil in January. There was an estimate today of 123 million metric ton crop. So, you know, if your window from a demand standpoint, from a U.S. export standpoint, right now is closing pretty quickly.
So I want to know from each of you, and I think I'll start, Dan, with you. No matter what you've got sold up front on your soybeans, and about 55%, I just looked at these numbers from USDA, of the soybeans are sold in the months of September and October, 35% in those 2 months, and then 55% when you add November and December in. That leaves 45% that's sold in the other months of the year. Do producers need to think, even at these lower prices, about selling more soybeans?
Well, I think so. I don't think they need to do it tomorrow or the next day, but I do think, given the yield, you know, we still have to kind of look at revenue per acre. I guess since we are getting a subsidy this year on the tariff situation, you got to kind of incorporate that in. And, you know, we are in, you know, we do farm to try to make a profit or at least break even anyway. We don't want to lose any more than what we're probably already going to maybe lose. So I think there's reason to consider selling additional corns and soybeans, depending upon, you know, how your cash flow needs are. But I don't think you have to do it in front of the October crop report. I think, I guess I would be willing to let the seasonalities try to work a little bit. I mean, we just basically have started moving seasonally to the upside here. So I would at least give it a few weeks to try to catch here and try to maybe take us into a normal, you know, November type high. But I do think, you know, usually you'll get a lot of seasonal weakness as you hit into December because people want to move some grain at the end of harvest, so want to move some grain for cash flow purposes and whatnot. So I do think, the October crop report, I'm sure, is going to be big, but I'm not too sure. Supply makes a lot of difference right now. Supply may make a difference toward the end of harvest, more so where we're trying to find a home for everything. I would give it a few weeks, but yes, I think farmers will have to take a look at either, you know, throwing some hedges on to try to earn some carry, wait for the basis to come in, do a hedge to arrive at the local elevator, or maybe sit down and talk to someone that's good at some of these derivative type contracts. That gives you downside price protection, but still gives you upside price potential if that would materialize. It's kind of hard to sell grain in the first week of October because historically that's the low. So I guess I would stay away from that because the statistics would say that you have a better chance of market going higher for one reason or the other. Than lower here at the first week of October, but we all know that we live in a little different world than we did a few years ago. But I guess seasonally, I would work with a market advisor of some kind that has those type of tools that lets you protect the downside, still take advantage of the upside, and see how things play out here over the next a month or two. Anyway,
as it happens, Alan Brugler is one of those market advisors with a toolbox. What do you think, Alan?
Yeah, we appreciate the referrals, Dan. Yeah, I'm in agreement for the most part with what he said. The basis is not good on the beans. It's telling you we don't want cash beans, all right? And some of that, if you're looking at a national number, is obviously influenced by the Dakota-Minnesota bid and the fact that they're not doing much volume to the PNW. What is going there is not for China, obviously. It's Taiwan and so forth. But, so it's telling you find a way to store these things. The basis is probably going to be bad all year relative to normal just because we're looking at 800 or 900 million bushel carryout because we've been so good at producing the stuff this year. But it ought to be better than we're seeing in the guts a lot of harvest. And I think you find a way to sit on the cash beans. We've got some put spreads in place to protect the downside, because if USDA were to go to a 53 or 54 bushel final yield, you could see sevens in front of the futures before you're done sometime during the marketing year. We don't see that right now. Again, it's trying to put in a seasonal low. Or on the corn side, the basis is not as bad, but it's still not. You still have to assume that it's a harvest basis and it'll get a little better. We've got this huge export program going on. I think that'll continue. Global stocks usage ratio, not counting China, is the tightest since 2000. So that tells you there's a big export draw out there for the next, at least until Brazil starts to get some volume out of harvest next spring. Again, the biggest danger I see for corn, and Steve alluded to this in our earlier conversation, was that if the farmer produces a whole bunch of corn in 2019, if we have 6-7 million more acres for some reason swinging away from beans to corn, you may be capped at 4.10 or 4.25 for futures for next year for Deese corn. And, we're hanging around $4 right now.
Well, I think two things. I think number one, each farmer is different. I mean, when you start talking about somebody that owns his own land, does not have a machinery cost, and maybe got 80 bushel beans, he definitely needs to sell. If you're talking about a farmer that didn't get those yields, he's got a higher cost of production, maybe he does wait for a seasonal. But I think most farmers believe in the beans that there will be a deal. And I think that's keeping them from selling things, because I don't know if it's right or not, but a lot of people think that if we walk in there some Monday morning and there is a deal, beans rally a dollar. And I don't think the farmer really wants to miss that. If you're kind of close to the pulse, you would have to say that most people are thinking there will not be a deal in 2019. So that means the beans are probably worth a dollar less. So I think that for 19, I would be an aggressive seller of beans, because I think South America is going to grow another record crop, and Argentina will have a normal crop. For nearby beans, we kind of think that at $10, the farmer was a pretty aggressive seller of beans. So we don't really know how much ownership there is. When you look at the September stocks report, the ownership of beans was in the commercial hands, not necessarily the farmer's hands. So, I think that, if there is a pop and we take out the stops at 870, the nearby beans, for some reason, then I would probably let the old crop go. But, wishing that we get a deal and have a dollar rally is probably not a very good marketing plan.
Where do you want to start marketing 19 crops?
As far as beans right here, you don't have to be real aggressive, but... I think earlier somebody said that if you have good crops next year, soybean futures could be at a 7. And again, nobody knows exactly what's going to happen, but you would hate to give up some of that on some of your production. I think a lot of people still think that corn is 40 cents undervalued and that we are going to get some kind of post-rally because of the demand side of things. If we do get a pop, hit stops over 370 on Deese corn, should be a scale-up seller, maybe into the 380 area for old crop. And like what was said earlier, get pretty close to 420 East 19 corn, you know, you probably want to be think about selling something. In fact, last week we even saw one analyst starting to sell 2020 corn. So, I mean, there are three things that people have to kind of realize. First of all, on the positive side, world food demand goes up every year. That's not necessarily here in the United States. And China's flattening out. But globally, food demand's going up. But on the negative side is that I don't think we've peaked as far as U.S. corn and soybean yields are concerned. And I don't think we've peaked as far as Russia and South American production is concerned. So start looking 10 years from now. We need a lot less acres planted here in the United States if nothing changes. We don't have a drought somewhere, something like that. So if you want to stay in the game, you're going to have to think about marketing plans and you know, think about cost of production and try to market grain in the carries when prices are good, because 6 months from now they may not be as good.
Alan, your 2019 a marketing plan in place already, and have you started to scale in sell on any crop?
We're doing a little bit of selling of 19 corn, basically $4 and every nickel higher on these 19. So we've just made the first 5% sale here. You know, if you do 5% at a time, that would take you up. If you take that all the way to the end, that's 20 sales, right? But we at least want to get started. And again, the main, we think there's better potential. If old crop gets a post-harvest rally, it'll drag new crop higher. So we don't want to hit it too hard right now, but we're pretty leery about that idea of a big expansion in U.S. acreage in 2019, because the bean situation is just so daunting with the carryover. We haven't done much on the beans yet, simply because of this idea that there's a window here where we'll do a little better than the prices we're staring at right now, whether that starts now or starts a little later because of some weather scare out of South America, I don't know. It bothers me that everybody's extremely complacent about South American yields being trend line or record when we're just getting the stuff out of the bag and planting right now.
Hey, so one other item for you, Alan, because you put this on your list, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal. Does that make much of a difference for corn in particular going into Mexico, or does it just hold the status quo?
Well, I think it stops, or, you know, the Mexicans were trying to make more moves towards diversifying their supplies, bringing in some from Brazil and Argentina and so forth. And this removes some of the incentive for them to do that, because the rail infrastructure is already there. You know, there's not a big a need for big adjustments to just keep doing what they're doing. I think it removes the risk of getting a big drop in U.S. exports, assuming, of course, we can get the dang thing ratified. But it's also a model. It shows that the administration is using actually fairly standard negotiating tactics, you know, the withdrawn offer, the red herring, and some of this stuff, to get some concessions. And I think you can look forward to some other deals being announced before the election, if at all possible, and whether that's Japan or Europe or somebody else.
Dan, anything for you on the 2019 marketings?
I guess I'm just too much of a seasonal person to be a big seller about anything down here. And then when I look at some of my cycle work here, my cycle work would say that the bean low is in place and we're going higher into April. I can't tell you what the fundamentals will be. Maybe everybody works in, you know, I know that the carryover for the U.S. supply looks terrible, but that keeps everybody good and short. And then if something would come along in South America or someplace else, then all those shorts have to buy their way out. And then it all of a sudden things change. So from a cyclical point of view, I have to be fairly friendly to soybeans, or I think the window of opportunity to move higher is greater then the window to move lower between now and April. Corn is probably somewhat of a contrarian. I think corn still has maybe may not recover as quickly as soybeans. I think corn could still waller around yet for a while, maybe until we get the crop harvest. I mean, everything has to find a home here first before the basis starts coming in. I guess I'm a little more bullish corn than soybeans than I am corn. I think corn, you know, has a much stronger balance sheet, at least on the surface. But if farmers are going to plug in another 7 million acres of corn next year and maybe drop soybean acres 7 million, well, then all of a sudden the market might start looking ahead at that and say there's no reason for corn to rally, but there maybe is a reason for beans to rally if you would get into some weather problems in South America. And, you know, statistically would say, you know, one of these years we're going to have a adverse weather situation. 12 was the big burner. We're 6 years away from that. Next year will be 7 years away. I would say the odds are better that there's going to be some kind of weather issues come at us in 19, more so than than having another record crop. So I guess I would be more patient. But if I would be selling anything, it would all have the option that I could take advantage of price strength as it comes forward. So I would not want to lock anything in that I couldn't take advantage of. Upside opportunities as I go into the normal seasonal strength period of April, May.
And now time for a final word from each of you. Alan Brugler, I think I'll start with you from Brugler Marketing and Management in Omaha, Nebraska.
Again, risk management is the key here. We know that the trading ranges are there over a course of 12 months. Corn's normally going to go $1.15 or so, low to high. Soybeans in a surplus stocks year is going to range about $1.70, but where are you in that range, and how do you manage your positions? We're big on option spreads in terms of controlling the directionality of our price risk when we're sitting on cash commodities. And again, with the basis being the typical harvest weakness, we want to sit on the cash commodity right here and retain some of that upside ownership potential.
Steve Fried of ADM Investor Services, your final thoughts?
We've got too much supply, no help from Washington, and I think farmers need to really sit down and have a better marketing plan and get some expert advice.
And Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting.
I don't know what to add other than what I said here a minute or two ago, that seasonally, I'm going to play the odds. I think there's better pricing opportunities ahead. But one also has to, you know, manage their own individual situation. And as far as the farm bill goes, you know, my opinion on farm bills is they usually make things worse than better. So maybe it might be better that we can't get anything passed. So, and that might bring production down. We get away from all these guarantees and encourages overproduction. And that's the biggest problem we have in U.S. agriculture is everything we do encourages overproduction.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online. Listen to the program in its entirety there at WILLAG.org. That's willag.org. Our thanks go this week to our panelists, including Steve Fried of ADM Investor Services out of Chicago, Illinois, Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting from Waco, Texas, and Alan Brugler of Brugler Marketing and Management from Omaha, Nebraska. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.